Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Courtroom Confidential, a weekly series covering headline-making criminal cases from across the country. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. I'm a former Los Angeles District Attorney and now a criminal defense attorney, bringing you what I hope are unique insights from both sides of the courtroom. Let's jump right in. First, we have breaking news out of Michigan. After deliberating for 10 hours, and requesting to stay late in court, a Michigan jury has found James Crumbley, the father of Oxford High School shooter Ethan Crumbley, guilty on 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter for his role in the shooting deaths of 4 students, Madison Baldwin, Justin Schilling, Tate Meyer, and Hannah St. Julian. Prosecutors argued Crumbley allowed his son to access the gun he used by failing to secure it, despite warning signs about the teen's deteriorating mental health. Crumbley's attorney insisted his client had no idea what his son was planning, and police cannot prove he did not lock up his guns. James's wife, Jennifer Crumbley, was convicted early in February on the same charges, and the cases presented by prosecutors had many overlapping facts and evidence. Notably, according to Ethan's school counselor, James told his son, quote, "You have people you can talk to. You can talk to your counselor. You have your journal. We can talk." This was said hours before the teen opened fire. However, law enforcement officials who searched the Crumbleys' home shortly after the attack testified that they had found the storage case for the gun lying open on the parents' bed, along with an empty box of ammunition, adding that there was no indication that the case had been locked and the case still had the default combination of 000. So what's going on here? Well, first of all, this has been said many times. This is a landmark case. It is really breaking new legal ground in what it's trying to do. And I think it's a mistake, first of all, to say that this case is about holding parents responsible. Really, what this case is about, holding anyone responsible for the independent actions of another person. Think about that. What this case said is that the Crumbleys, Jennifer first, now James, both have been convicted by 12 jurors, that they made so many mistakes, that they were so negligent in how they were parenting, that they ignored so many red flags and warning signs, that they should be held accountable for another person taking independent steps that led to the loss of life. It should not be ignored that Ethan Crumbley is the person who pulled the trigger here. He is the one that went into his parents' bedroom, retrieved that gun, concealed that from everyone, concealed it inside of his backpack that day, took it to school without anyone else's knowledge, and opened fire. And the government, the state, the prosecution is saying that the parents should be held responsible for those actions because they were negligent in the way that they parented him, that they should have foreseen something like this could happen, and they're being held responsible for those deaths. These are not charges of negligent parenting. These are charges of involuntary manslaughter, holding somebody responsible for deaths caused at the hands of another person whose actions they were unaware of and whose actions were independent. Now, listen, I share the frustration that everyone has in this country with these school shootings. And I know that we're all desperate to do something to stop it and hold people accountable. And I understand the prosecutors are coming from a place of saying this has to stop. But the criminal law is about drawing lines. Lines so that we understand what behaviors are illegal, what behaviors are criminal, what things shouldn't we do or say that could break the law and wind us up in prison, perhaps for a very significant amount of time. And what line is this drawing? Is the line that you can't be a negligent parent? You have to do more to intervene in the mental crisis that your child might be suffering? Is the line that you have to do a better job of locking up your weapon? Well, they had a safe. I'm not saying that that was good enough. I'm not trying to make excuses for their behavior. I'm saying, what should we all as a society learn from this moving forward are things that we should avoid doing. And I know people will say, well, that's pretty obvious. You can't have a gun in the house with a mentally unstable person. Well, is that the line? Is that what we're saying is the line, that anybody is now held responsible if they have a gun in a house and a person who's showing signs of mental instability and they go out and do something awful? Again, I understand the frustrations. My biggest concern in all of this is, where are we drawing the line and what are we all supposed to learn about moving forward? Many people have talked about, well, this is setting a precedent. It's a slippery slope. I agree with some of those comments. I agree that the facts of this case were egregious. But my biggest question is, moving forward from all of this, what are other parents or other people, not just parents and children, other people supposed to learn from this about behavior that's unacceptable? And maybe that's clear to some. It's not entirely clear to me, because I think it's saying that, hey, if you have this type of situation where somebody's mentally unstable and they've shown that they have signs of being violent, perhaps towards themselves or others, and if you have a gun, and if that gun is not properly secured, and if you know that that person might have access to that gun, there's a lot going on here that I don't think the precedent is clear enough. But now two sets of jurors have thought about this differently than I have. They have viewed the law, been handed it to them. I respect the decisions and the verdicts that they've come out with. But it is a landmark case, and it is something that I think we will all be talking about for a long time after this. Now, moving on to Massachusetts, parties in the Karen Ree case were back in court Tuesday to argue multiple motions, including a motion to dismiss and a motion to disqualify and sanction the prosecutor's office. Reed is charged with second-degree murder in the death of her boyfriend, Boston police officer John O'Keefe, who was found dead in the snow outside the home of a fellow police officer after a night of drinking in January of 2022. Investigators have accused Reed of hitting O'Keefe with her car and then leaving him to die in the snow. Reed's defense team has countered by accusing the police of conducting a sloppy investigation and covering up a fight inside the house that led to O'Keefe's death. The defense further alleged that a federal expert concluded evidence does not support that O'Keefe was hit by an SUV, as prosecutors allege. Reed's defense listed several examples of what they described as, quote, distortions of evidence that intentionally misled the state grand jury into delivering a flawed indictment, adding that the grand jury presentation was packed with lies and deceptions from investigators who deliberately concealed personal relationships between key witnesses, including the owners of the home where O'Keefe was found dead and guests at the party. Finally, the defense alleges that an internet search for how long to die in cold, that in quotes, how long to die in cold, allegedly made by one of the party guests, was not presented to the grand jury. In response to all of this, the prosecution maintained that none of the defense's examples met the high burden necessary to dismiss the indictment and did not advance the defense's claim that someone else is responsible for Keith's death. The judge reserved ruling on the motions, and Reed is still scheduled to go to trial on April 16th. All right, what's going on here? Well, first, I think it's really important to understand exactly what a grand jury is. A grand jury is what we refer to as a probable cause hearing. In most jurisdictions in this country, when you are charged with felony, you are entitled to what's called a probable cause hearing of some sort. In many places, I practice in Los Angeles, California. The main way that this is done is through what's called a preliminary hearing. And this is where evidence is presented in court to a judge. There's no jury present. And that is just to show, because the judge, by the way, doesn't know the facts of the case. The judge presiding over this just knows what the allegations are. They may have a criminal complaint in front of them, but they don't know the underlying facts. So this is an opportunity to present some of those facts to the judge. And the judge is not making a decision about beyond reasonable doubt. The judge is merely trying to decide, is there enough probable cause, which is a far lower standard, is there enough probable cause to believe that the person here in court committed the crime alleged on the date alleged? And if that it rises to that lower standard, then that person is in some jurisdictions, it's called held over, bound over. In any case, they're now going to face trial. It's a measure to make sure that we don't force people to go to trial when a judge has never even taken a look at the prosecution's evidence. It's a probable cause hearing, a much lower standard. In other jurisdictions, it's far more common to conduct that through what's called a grand jury. That does take place here in California, where I practice, but it's far more rare, used in usually circumstances where the case is so complex that a preliminary hearing might take months, or in a case where there's an attempt to keep the hearing private, because a grand jury is kept private. It's not a public hearing. And so perhaps for some reason, the case is still ongoing in its investigation. You don't want to release all the people who are testifying and have them testify in court. But an important distinction is at a preliminary hearing, the defense is allowed to be present. They're allowed to question the witnesses. They're allowed to even perhaps put on an affirmative defense of their own. They can test that evidence and challenge it and then have a judge decide. In a grand jury, the prosecution essentially wears two hats. The prosecution is presenting the prosecution's case, but there is a responsibility that they at least present some of what is expected to be the defense case or exculpatory evidence. And that's where the problem often lies in those details. The devil's always in the details. And that's where the problem sometimes lies, is that many times the defense will, once the grand jury is done, once an indictment has been handed down, and now they're taking a look at the transcripts, they go, you guys didn't ask any of the right questions. You guys didn't present any of the exculpatory evidence. You guys did a horrible job of representing both sides of this case. So the grand jury was only getting one very biased view of the evidence, and their indictment, therefore, is not a true test of probable cause and of the evidence itself. I have made those challenges myself. I believe that oftentimes the prosecution is lacking in the way that they present their case. I believe that sometimes the prosecution makes arguments to the grand jury. They give a closing to some extent to the grand jury in asking them to return their indictment. Sometimes that might be full of arguments that I would challenge had I been present in court. And it's incredibly frustrating as the defense to read through all of that and say, I cannot believe they indicted my client on all of this. You've heard the phrase used before. A grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. And though I believe that may not be entirely true, it does seem like if you're only got one team on the field, it's pretty easy to score a goal. And so you can understand the frustration of the defense in this case, and you can understand the attacks that they're making. But the prosecution's point of what they have to prove, and that is a very high standard, is also very true. Judges are reluctant to overturn indictments based on those types of arguments unless the bias on the part of the prosecution was so significant that there's nothing that can be done about it. The reason for that is, one, we want some finality in these hearings. And the other reason for that is that this is not the trial. This is just saying, is there enough evidence for this to go to trial? That's a much lower standard. Even had this case, I would argue, gone to a preliminary hearing where the defense would have been given full opportunity to cross-examine all of the prosecution's witnesses, it is very likely, given what we know about this case, that that still would have survived the preliminary hearing and headed towards a trial. So I think that's really where this is all coming from, and why we're seeing the arguments made in this case. And I think the judge will make the same ruling that I'm arguing the judge probably will, which will be to hold Karen Reed to answer at trial in this case. All right, finally, Texas man Kerry Birmingham was sentenced early last week for fatally shooting his wife in December of 2021, shortly after discovering she had been having an affair. Footage captured by his wife, Patricia, moments before her death shows Birmingham clutching a shotgun in the driveway of their home as he points it at her. We have some of that footage. I will tell you it is troubling, and we're going to show that to you now.
You really want this on video?
I'll pull it. I'm mad enough to pull it. Okay. All right. Goodbye, Bruce.
Nice to know you. You don't meet Jesus.
I got to say, I've been doing this for a very long time, and to see something like that, it's just so chilling. When you realize that the person holding the camera, the person taking that video, is the person who loses their life mere moments after that video ends. Now, what's also remarkable about this case is that, surprising to many observers of the trial, Birmingham was sentenced to just 10 years in prison for the murder and will be up for parole after 5 years. The all-female jury decided against the maximum sentence of 20 years. All right, what's going on here? First, this is a great example of how sentencing laws are very different in each jurisdiction across our country. In many jurisdictions, the jury is considered the finders of fact. They are the ones who just decide what happened. They've heard all the evidence. There may have been conflicting evidence. There may have been strong and weak evidence, and they evaluate all of that and they decide what happened. What are the facts? After they get the facts, the judge provides to them the law, and they then have to decide, do these facts match with the law that's given to me? And if it does, beyond a reasonable doubt, I return a verdict of guilty. And if it doesn't, I return a verdict of not guilty. And that's where their job ends. As far as sentencing goes, it's usually in the hands of the judge. The judge will decide based upon the statutes and legislation and sentencing guidelines what that person will be sentenced to. It's in most jurisdictions, it's important to understand too, there's a range. There's a amount of time that we understand where this will likely fall. It's not just picked out of a hat. But in some jurisdictions, as we're finding out here in Texas, the sentence is decided by the very same jury. So now you have the jury who's decided guilt. They're the ones making the decision to what that person will be sentenced to. And again, there's guidelines, but they're the one choosing. In this case, instead of going with the maximum of 20, the jury decided on 10. And you may be thinking to yourself, at first blush, that sounds right. That sounds like, hey, I don't know if I want one person deciding what the sentence should be. Now I have 12 people deciding, and those people have listened to all of the evidence, and they're probably the best people to assess what the actual mitigating and aggravating circumstances are of this crime in arriving at their decision. Those are good points. The problem here to me is that those jurors, that may be the first and only trial they have ever served on, and the first and only trial they have ever even watched. I've known many jurors who come into court, and it's their first time being in a courtroom. The judge, however, may have presided over hundreds of trials, may have been involved as a lawyer themselves in hundreds of trials before that. And they have the benefit of this wide amount of, call it data, to inform their decision on sentencing. They have seen from the most egregious to the least, from cases that are can only be described as heinous and awful, to cases where, yes, that person may have committed a crime, but there's plenty of mitigating circumstances that should inform their decision. The jurors just simply don't have that type of experience. And to me, maybe it's just where I practice and what I'm used to, but it's very troubling to put this decision in the hands of jurors. But that's the law in Texas, and that's how they decided it. And I will respect that. One more thing, a point I'll make about all of this is that this case involved It was essentially a manslaughter case based upon like this idea of heat of passion, that in the spur of the moment, he appears to be intoxicated in that video. And in the heat of passion and the heat of that moment, he grabs a shotgun. He just found out his wife has been cheating on him, and he makes this awful, awful decision. And an all-female jury took a look at all of those circumstances, and they, for whatever reasons, and I don't know, I'm just trying to divine and read the tea leaves from what I've observed and read about this case, but they decided that there were mitigating circumstances here. And that was just interesting to me. I wonder, had it been a jury of a different makeup, a jury of all 12 men or a mix, if they would have had the same conclusion. And I'm not trying to make any kind of assumptions about how women think or men think, but it was interesting to me. And it, maybe that's just it. Maybe I'm just bringing up the question and the interesting aspect of it. Call it sympathetic, call it merciful to a person who took a woman's life, but because of this surrounding circumstance that you were dealing with infidelity. All right. Also making headlines this week out of Kentucky, nearly 8 years after Bryce Rhodes was charged with brutally murdering three people, including two teenage brothers, his case finally concluded Wednesday with a judge following a jury's recommendation of a sentence that he spend the rest of his life in prison without the possibility of parole. Also in Florida, prosecutors announced Tuesday that they are filing 60 new criminal sex abuse charges against Stephen Stearns, a suspect in the death of 13-year-old Madeline Soto. Stearns, who is dating Madeline's mother, was first arrested after Madeline was reported missing when her mother went to pick her up from middle school. While he has not been charged yet in Soto's death, prosecutors allege that Stearns had been abusing Madeline for at least 2 years. And finally, out of Arizona, seven people accused of killing 16-year-old Preston Lord at a Halloween party in October pleaded not guilty on Wednesday to the charges in connection to his death. Ranging in age from 17 to 20 years old, all of the defendants will be charged as adults for first-degree murder charges. That is an incredible amount of exposure that they could be looking at. And finally, on the docket for next week, out of Indiana, a contempt hearing is scheduled for March 18th for Delphi murder suspect Richard Allen's defense team relating to the evidence leaked tied to the attorneys, along with violations of a gag order. Also out of Alabama, a plea hearing is set for March 21st for Carly Russell. You may remember Russell made national headlines last summer for allegedly falsely telling police she was abducted and went missing for 2 days after stopping her car to check on a toddler wandering near a highway. Authorities maintained that they had to expend a huge amount of resources to search for and investigate Russell's claims, which they now claim are completely planned and staged by Russell. Once again, I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. You can find me on social media platforms at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. And thank you again for joining me. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and share your thoughts on these cases in the comments. And feel free to suggest cases that you'd like me to cover in the future. Have a great weekend. I'll see you next week. And thank you again for joining us for another episode of Courtroom Confidential.